How's everybody feeling out there? Anybody besides me feeling a little bit salty? Just me? All right. Well, I want to start off this morning with a story. About a young man, 23 years old, living in Jefferson City, Missouri. So for the sake of the story, we'll call this young man Joe. Energetic and ambitious, he started his career investigating fraud. He had a knack for writing and persuasion. He went on to help shape an industry, taking on the federal government, monopolists, and even the wealthiest and most powerful industry in the world. I'm talking, of course, about Joseph Pulitzer. And just like Alfred Nobel, he's known more for the prize that bears his name than the truly extraordinary life that he led. We're going to talk about Joseph Pulitzer this morning because the lessons we can learn from him are more critical today than ever. Pulitzer was a newspaper man in an era when journalism was more sport than profession, with newspapers competing through sensationalism. As a young journalist, Pulitzer advocated accuracy and objectivity and took on corruption and robber barons. His reporting contributed to the passage of the Sherman Antitrust Act and to the eventual breakup of Standard Oil. At the height of his career, he briefly lost sight of those principles. He allowed himself to be goaded into a propaganda rivalry with William Randolph Hearst that contributed to drawing the U.S. into the Spanish-American War. Pulitzer saw firsthand the destructive power of his own yellow journalism that he despised. He recommitted himself to the principles of accuracy in journalism. He founded the first school of journalism at Columbia University to try to develop journalists as principled professionals rather than just competing propagandists. And he started the Pulitzer Prize to promote excellence in journalism. His message was that the very first principle of journalism should be the truth. The truth matters. Democracy itself relies on citizens having accurate facts in a meaningful context. Without that, democracy is no better than authoritarianism. And so that is my message this morning. The truth matters. Now, the MBB started out as a research organization. Our heritage is in science and data. That heritage values truth and scorns distortion and dishonesty. Our industry set out to respond to what every U.S. president in the last 40 years said was a major national priority, addressing our dangerous addiction to a singular source of transportation fuel, which undermines our entire economy. 2007, there was finally a policy that boldly laid out a plan to actually address that addiction, the renewable fuel standard. After 40 years and 8 presidents talking about the need to do something about this highest of priorities, President Bush signed bipartisan legislation to actually do something. So we now have 7 years with this policy. 7 years of struggle between those who want to make the policy work, those who want to make it fail and ultimately be abandoned in favor of the status quo. 7 years of public statements, congressional testimony, rulemakings, and court cases. So let's look back at the predictions from both sides of this battle to see who was right and who was wrong. Who used fact-based arguments and who used alarmist and misleading rhetoric. This morning, we're going to put it out there in the sunlight and urge our government officials to take notice. Now, I want to make something very clear. This speech is about the policy debate over the renewable fuel standard. No one should perceive my remarks as any kind of sweeping attack on the petroleum industry. I know tons of great people in the petroleum industry who are doing good things for the country, including our own chairman. Many segments of the petroleum industry have supported the goal of diversifying our energy portfolio. The heating oil industry is the best example, but also petroleum distributors, lenders, pipeline companies, and others have embraced biodiesel, the RFS law, and the objective of diversification. So my criticism today is specifically of those who are distorting facts in their opposition to the RFS. The great philosopher Jack Handy once said, before you criticize someone, you should walk a mile in their shoes. That way, when you do criticize them, you'll be a mile away and you'll have their shoes. So looking back at the public record, there are many examples of misrepresentation of biodiesel by RFS opponents. If that's for me, just take a message. So for the sake of time, I'll provide just three. The first is a consistent pattern of distorting the biodiesel industry's production capability. In August of 2011, NPRA stated in their comments, "It is unrealistic to expect domestic biodiesel blending volume to increase significantly this year to meet the regulatory volume of 800 million gallons, increase again in 2012 to 1 billion gallons, and increase again to 1.28 billion gallons in 2013. These annual steps are much too large for an industry that produced only 311 million gallons in 2010. Now, there are two major misrepresentations in this statement. First, they say that we can't produce 800 million gallons in 2011 when they know we had produced almost that much in 2008. But then they also use the year-old volume of 311 million gallons as a predictor of the current year's production when we had 7 months of current year's production data available. We had already produced 500 million gallons and had almost half the year left to go. Their statement in this submission and so many others tells a story that just isn't true. Our comments and same rulemaking laid out comprehensive production and economic data, feedstock availability, and other factors that provided ample evidence that we would have no trouble meeting 800 million gallons in 2011, billion gallons in 2012, and way more than 1.28 billion gallons in 2013. Of course, those volumes were met or exceeded. Our fact-based, data-driven approach prevailed against their misleading claims. The second example of disingenuousness on the part of some RFS opponents is their position on indirect land use change in measuring life cycle carbon. Some RFS opponents advocated early on that indirect land use change for biofuels would be large and should be counted against biofuels, yet they simultaneously also argued that indirect effects of petroleum on land, water, military activity in oil regions should not be measured. They convinced Washington that petroleum's carbon be assumed forevermore to be that of 2005 light sweet crude. Three and four iterations of speculated indirect effects were assigned to biodiesel, while petroleum was assumed to have no indirect effects. This continues to be the methodology used to assign carbon intensity scores to fuels, even though we all knew at the time, and now everyone should acknowledge, that the opposite is true on both counts. The U.S. petroleum industry now boasts that America has achieved energy independence thanks to the North American oil boom that has been made possible by fracking of shale oil and strip mining of Canadian tar sands. This new supply of non-conventional crude is significantly more carbon intense than 2005 light sweet crude. That's not even counting land and water use effects. These are photos I took last year flying home from the conference. This is the kind of land use change from petroleum that you can see from 30,000 feet on a commercial flight. And these aren't even indirect effects. They are direct effects. Here's a common example of a farm field in North Dakota in 2003. That same farm field today. And this is going on all over the country. It was argued that biofuels would lead to clearing of land to increase farmland. Guess what? It didn't happen. There was a session this morning called Mythbusters that laid out the evidence that biofuels' indirect land use change myth is busted. So I won't repeat all that information that was shared, but it was quite comprehensive. Same goes for the food versus fuel myth, busted. We are, however, losing farmland to fracking fuels, but no one is talking about food versus that fuel. What is indisputably leading to land clearing is the mining of tar sands. The boreal forests and peatlands that overlie the tar sands contribute to making this region one of the most carbon-rich storage systems on the planet, holding almost twice as much carbon per area as tropical and rainforests. Referred to by the tar sands industry as overburden, These forests are scraped off, wetlands dredged, to be replaced with tar mines like this. If anyone questions whether this constitutes significant land use change, you can go on Google Earth and see these pits from 7,000 miles in space. So to reiterate, when it comes to assessing life cycle carbon fuels, some RFS opponents maintain to this day that indirect land use change that didn't happen continued to be counted against biodiesel. But direct land use change that you can see from a commercial flight and in some cases from space continue to not be counted against baseline petroleum. Now, for my last example, if you haven't been impressed so far with the level of misinformation being used against biodiesel, stay with me on this one because it's a doozy. In October 2012, API released a study that predicted that the RFS would result in a diesel death spiral that would cause 300% increase in the cost of diesel fuel in 2014 and collapse the economy in 2015. They come up with this by first creating a biodiesel blend wall myth and assert that if biodiesel exceeds this imaginary 5% blend wall, it will drive diesel prices to about $15 per gallon in 2014. On July 23, 2013, API testified about this imminent collapse before the House Energy and Commerce Committee, Committee of Jurisdiction for the RFS. Take a look.
According to a study conducted by NERA Economic Consulting, exceeding the blend wall could result in diesel fuel costs rising as much as 300% and a 30% increase in gasoline costs by 2015. In broad economic terms, the RFS could cause a $770 billion decrease in U.S. GDP by 2015 and reduce take-home pay for American workers by $580 billion.
The diesel death spiral. That is really what they call it. Seems like they were trying to conjure up imagery of the RFS as a dark and evil force that must be opposed at all costs. Let's take a look at exactly what API's study said would happen. The study assumed a volume of 1.35 billion gallons of biomass-based diesel was blended into the diesel fuel supply in 2012, 1.74 billion gallons in 2013, and 1.66 billion gallons in 2014. Does that sound familiar? The only accurate part of this study is the amounts that they guessed for biodiesel that would be blended in during these years. They were shockingly accurate, yet we exceeded them. So let's look at what they said would happen if these volumes of biodiesel were used. They said the RFS would increase diesel fuel costs to about $15 per gallon in 2014 and about $70 per gallon in 2015. Not $70 per barrel, $70 per gallon. We told API, the White House, EPA, and others that the NERA study was fatally flawed. And despite all those alarmist warnings of economic collapse, none of it actually happened. In fact, the reverse happened. Our industry supplied almost exactly the amounts assumed in the study under the high volume scenario, and we did not have $15 a gallon diesel fuel in 2014. Can we all just agree on that?
Yeah.
And here we are in 2015, and we don't have $70 per gallon diesel fuel as the study predicted. Okay, so surely, after making such a wild prediction that didn't come true, API went back and corrected the record, right? Wrong. If you go to API's website right now, prominently featured on the site is RFS facts, including the fact that the RFS will lead to a 300% increase in diesel fuel, $770 billion loss of GDP, etc. Come on, guys, really? They even cited these same crazy bullet points in a live press conference just a couple weeks ago. That would be like the Mayan calendar nut jobs continuing to insist that the world is still going to end in 2012. Sensationalist tabloid headlines have no place in serious public policy debate. It makes for bad public policy. Just like Pinocchio makes a bad motivational speaker.
And I see nothing but untapped potential. You have potential. You have... Oh boy.
You like that one? We are appealing to our colleagues at API to publicly disavow the NERA study and to inform the House Energy and Commerce Committee that the July 23rd, 2013 testimony was in error. Specifically, that the RFS did not cause any of the catastrophic harm to fuel prices or the economy that they said it would, and that there is not a B5 blend law. Joseph Pulitzer, who founded the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, was a champion of truthfulness in public discourse. Pulitzer was a supporter of free speech, for sure, but someone's speech that deliberately deceives others for the purpose of self-enrichment is not constitutionally protected. Pulitzer exposed fraud and corruption in both government and business. He pursued that interest in a stint with a stint in Jefferson City as a member of the Missouri General Assembly. He lived in a boarding house just a couple of miles away from where the NDB's headquarters building stands today. The petroleum market is today being distorted by actions of hostile nations and an international cartel. This past Thanksgiving Day, OPEC ministers gave U.S. consumers something to be thankful for. Even though the global price of crude had fallen by 40% in the previous 4 months amidst a global glut of oil, OPEC, led by Saudi Arabia, decided not to decrease production levels. Why did they do this? Because crude prices below the $50 to $70 range threatened to bankrupt fracking projects in the U.S. and around the world. Saudi Arabia is sitting on nearly $1 trillion in cash and has production costs of $5 to $6 per barrel. The Saudis can outlast all their competitors. And this is what monopolies and cartels do. They use anti-competitive tactics to raise, or in this case, lower prices to squeeze out competitors and alternatives out of the market. Then they artificially increase prices to maximize their profits. There are potentially even more dangerous side effects of this predatory activity. The dramatic drop in global crude prices has brought Russia's oil-dependent economy to the brink. Some suspect that the situation could trigger desperate measures by Russia, particularly in a ramp-up of mischief-making in the Middle East, with the intention of further increasing instability, artificially shocking oil prices to prop up Russia's economy. The recent actions of OPEC are reminiscent of a fundamental event in the formation of our nation, the Boston Tea Party. It's remembered as a revolt against a tax increase on tea. It was actually a revolt against a tax cut on tea coming from Britain's state-assigned monopoly, the East India Tea Company. A tax increase in 1767 led to imports of cheaper tea smuggled in from Holland and a huge buildup of inventories of tea in Britain. So the Tea Act of 1773 that directly led to the Boston Tea Party was actually a tax cut, allowing the British to lower prices and dump their excess inventories while simultaneously squeezing out the competition. This wasn't lost on the colonists. They realized that this tax cut was a predatory tactic by the British and their monopoly. The dumping of the tea in Boston Harbor was a symbolic reaction to the dumping of the tea on the colonies. It was the world's first anti-dumping case. The protest against the tea monopoly was so strong that it became unpatriotic to even drink tea. So Americans turned to coffee. The roots of our nation were based on the rejection, in part, the rejection of a monopolistic system. It's no coincidence that Scotsman Adam Smith, the father of free market economics, wrote his Capitalist Manifesto on the Wealth of Nations in 1776, at the same time that America's founding fathers were declaring their political independence. The American Revolution was every bit as much about escaping monopoly and disbursement of economic power as escaping from monarchy and dispersing political power. Adam Smith was fiercely opposed to cartels and monopoly as anti-competitive and anti-free market, and favored government policy to weaken it. Imagine if Adam Smith could see our economic system today, where a single, highly unstable commodity has come to dominate virtually all global transportation, forming a virtual product monopoly. Too many people who invoke Adam Smith forget that the first free market economists saw cartels and monopolies as the biggest threat to competition, which formed the foundation of capitalism. Joseph Pulitzer observed that the rise of robber barons and monopolies and their disproportionate levels of commercial and political influence corresponded to a rise in propaganda and sensationalism in public discourse. Sensationalism and polarized politics led to a cynicism where everyone sought out their own information sources that fed their ideology. This created an environment where everyone was expected to exaggerate and distort their agenda. Today, journalism is again facing a similar challenge. 24-hour cable news channels, partisan pseudo-news internet sites have brought back an era that exaggerates, sensationalizes, and panders to particular ideologies. That has contributed to the return of hyper-polarized politics, because we seek out information sources that feed our confirmation bias and tribalism. This is a challenge to a functioning democratic system. But just like Pulitzer and other concerned citizens did in the past, we must push back and insist that truth be a public virtue. President Obama has declared an all-of-the-above energy policy and made addressing climate change a priority. The RFS has demonstrated success in contributing to both of those top priorities. But in 2014, the RFS got off track. It's our goal to get it back on track in 2015. How do we do that? In 2009, NBB proposed a reasonable plan for modest, sustainable growth of the biodiesel industry and the advanced biofuels under the RFS. The proposal called for the EPA to grow the biomass-based diesel program by about 300 million gallons a year. This proposal was based on comprehensive, conservative, economic and agronomic analysis. Now we know that our projections were even more conservative than we thought at the time. Carried out to the year 2022, that would get us to our stated industry vision of 10 by 22, or about 4 billion gallons. For the last half of 2013, biodiesel was at an annualized level of over 2.1 billion gallons. That's the level that we proposed for 2016, and we hit it 3 years early in 2013 without any of the negative side effects our alarmist opponents insisted would happen. In fact, while biodiesel volumes were increasing dramatically, both diesel fuel and feedstock prices decreased. So we demonstrated that our sustainable growth plan is a sensible path to fulfilling the goals of the RFS while meeting the vision of our industry. This was the vision for the future of the RFS and the future of the industry. The EPA has said that 2015 is the year they want to get the RFS program back on track, finalizing 2014, 2015, and 2016 volumes all in this 2015 calendar year. We want to help them do that. Yarfest is now stuck in the past, and we need to bring it back to the future. Incidentally, 2015 marks the 30th anniversary of Steven Spielberg's Back to the Future. Here's a quick clip to remind you of how awesome that movie was.
Does it run like on regular online gasoline?
Unfortunately, no. It requires something with a little more kick. Plutonium!
Ow, plutonium. Wait a minute. Are you telling me that this sucker is nuclear?
Hey, keep going here. No, this sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity I need.
Doc, you don't just walk into a store and buy plutonium. Did you rip that off?
Of course, from a group of Libyan nationalists. They wanted me to build them a bomb, so I took their plutonium and turned into a shiny bomb casing full of used pinball machine parts. Come on, let's get you a radiation suit.
Look at my driver's license. Expires 1987. Look at my birthday, for crying out loud. I haven't even been born yet. Doc, you can't believe me.
Now tell me, future boy, who's president of the United States in 1985?
Ronald Reagan. The actor? Fuck! Then who's vice president?
Jerry Lewis?
Still bruising your head. I know how that happened. You told me the whole story. You were standing on your toilet and you were hanging the clock and you fell and you hit your head on the sink. And that's when you came up with the idea for the flux capacitor, which is what makes time travel possible.
Second movie, they went from 1985 forward 30 years to 2015. That's a little screenshot of the DeLorean there. It's funny to watch that movie again and see what Spielberg predicted life would be like in 2015. He accurately predicted flat screen TVs, video phones, computer tablets, and Google Glass. It's interesting to me that 1985 and 2015 have a lot of striking similarities. 1985 was a turning point for the country. We had just gone through a decade and a half of misery. Vietnam, Watergate, the Arab oil embargo, the biggest oil shock in history, the Iran hostage crisis, Olympic terrorism, Cold War boycotts, the worst recession since the Great Depression. The stock market lost nearly 45% of its value during the time period. Farmers were losing their farms at alarming rates. But by 1985, something had shifted. The economy was growing. The stock market was rising. There was a new era of confidence and optimism that kicked off a decade and a half of tremendous prosperity and opportunity. In many ways, I think that 2015 has the potential to be the same kind of pivotal moment we had in 1985. We've just gone through a decade and a half of mess, beginning with Y2K and a recession in 2000, the attacks of 9/11, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, with some of the worst hurricanes with Rita, Katrina, and Sandy, the Indonesian tsunami, and the Japanese tsunami, a nuclear disaster. We had the biggest oil shock in history in 2008, followed by the Great Recession. The banking industry was collapsing. The auto industry was collapsing. The stock market was collapsing. Hostess collapsed and gave us Twinkie Mageddon. The biggest oil spill in 2010. Some of the worst flooding in 2011, followed by one of the worst droughts in 2012. Let's face it, we just went through a decade and a half of weapons-grade weirdness. But something has now shifted. The economy has been growing and increasing its momentum. The stock market has been setting records and still going strong. 2015 could be another 1985. Could be a launching point for unprecedented growth, opportunity, and prosperity. This could be the year that we get back to the future. 2015 was intended to be a turning point for the RFS. For the first 7 years, conventional biofuel was designed to lead the growth in the volumes until 2015, where conventional biofuel is statutorily capped at 15 billion gallons. From 2015 on, advanced biofuels are intended to lead the growth of the program. And so far, biomass-based diesel has emerged as the only domestically produced, fully commercialized advanced biofuel. America's advanced biofuel. We've caused the program to meet its goals every year. 2015 has to be the year we get back to the future of this program and out of the uncertainty of the past. So how can we possibly make this happen against such overwhelming odds? Because we simply must. We have always had to fight and scrap and struggle, and we're up against some very powerful opposition. But as my granddad used to say, what counts the most is not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog. We have to remain united and continue to lead as an industry who is committed to facts and the truth. We have to insist that our government officials take notice of this commitment. We have to insist that our government be held accountable and that they hold stakeholders accountable for their truthfulness of their statements. The truth matters. The truth unites. The truth empowers. Now, I want to make one more appeal to our colleagues in the petroleum industry who are opposing the RFS. It was an appeal. It's an appeal to work together for the good of our respective industries and the good of the country. It's an appeal that also was also made by Congressman Ralph Hall of Texas at the same July 2013 RFS hearing that I discussed earlier and that I also testified. At 90 years old, Congressman Hall was the oldest serving member of Congress. He represented the district just next door to this one. Congressman Hall made what I thought were some of the most compelling remarks of anyone at that hearing that day. Take a listen.
I know most of you there that have invested and have built the country and are relying on a reasonable, well thought out answer to this problem. You might feel like the button people felt when the zipper guy came along, but for your knowledge, the button companies are still going and the zipper companies are all going together. So we need to work something that's satisfactory to all five of the folks you all represent there.
Doesn't have to be buttons versus zippers. I bet that everyone in this room right now is wearing both buttons and zippers, and we're all better off for it. Buttons and zippers are better together, and biodiesel and diesel fuel are better together too. Democracy not only relies on a well-informed citizenry armed with the truth, but it also relies on that citizenry to collaborate, to solve problems of both culture and commerce. Winston Churchill once said, democracy is the worst system of government, except for the others. Democracy is difficult, but nothing good is easy. Our government may be flawed, but that doesn't mean we give up. The RFS is good policy. It is pro-competitive, pro-consumer, free market, capitalist policy. If Joseph Pulitzer and Adam Smith were here today, they would cheer the RFS. 2015 is the year we get back to the future of this program, back to the future of this industry, back to the future of this country. We are the ones on the right side of history. We have a powerful force on our side. The truth. So rise up with me, people. Rise up and tell our story. Let's get back to the RFS.